You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to late 30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on, it's the 30th of July. We've almost done with July this year.
Bye-bye Christmas in July.
Yes. This is Sonia.
This is Jesse.
And it's just us in the studio
just
today. But thank you to Earth Matters for that show coming from the Women's Climate Congress, which was held in Castlemaine, a while back now, I feel. But an interesting lineup of speakers there. And that's what we have as well. An interesting lineup of speakers.
Look at that segue. We do. today we'll be speaking with Eugene Doyle, who is a writer based in Wellington, and he's written extensively on the Middle East. Today we'll be speaking with him actually about the 80th anniversary of the commemoration of Nagasaki, which is of course when the US military dropped nuclear bombs on civilians in Nagasaki in Japan.
And it's worth remembering that the United States is the only country in the world to have dropped nuclear bombs in an act of war.
Absolutely.
Obviously, there have been nuclear testing that has affected civilians in the Pacific and things, but yeah.
Yes, so a significant anniversary, 80 years since then. And we'll be talking about that, but actually also the response from countries like Australia. Listeners may remember that last year Israel was actually uninvited to the commemoration ceremony. And as a response to that, of course, we saw the G7 nations plus Australia and New Zealand say, oh, well, we're not going if Israel can't go because we love Israel so much. So we'll be talking a bit about that.
And then at around 7:30, we'll be talking with Dr. Scott Bennett, who is a senior lecturer in marine ecology at the University of Tasmania, about the algal blooms, which are still causing devastation in the oceans off South Australia. But in particular, what the long-term impacts are and when, if we will see an end to these this devastation.
Yes, and then following that, we'll catch up again with Roscoe Lee Brown from Radio RADA. Roscoe has got some more updates from Kanaki and from the International Seabed Authority meeting, which happened in Jamaica. It finished up last week, I believe.
And at the turn of the hour, we'll be having some updates, just very quickly, on the ongoing picket happening at Racecourse Road in Flemington, where drilling has taken place. This is to do with the demolition of the housing towers and trying to prevent them.
And then finally, we will hear the last part of the four-part interview we had with two Iranian activists regarding the 12-day war between Israel and Iran. And we'll be speaking about, I guess, the potential for negotiations or potential for avoiding another 12-day war, hopefully not much longer or not at all. Yeah.
And before all that, let's go to the news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now. One, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah.
Right down to the real nitty-gritty. And these are the news headlines for this Wednesday, the 30th of July. It's 7:05. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM Wednesday breakfast. We're beginning in Iran, where serious questions are being raised about the integrity of data used to shape Western perceptions of the nation. A Netherlands-based group called GAMAAN has been publishing polls suggesting Iranians are largely secular and anti-government, but an investigation has revealed the group has extensive ties to US-funded networks that advocate for regime change. The findings from the agency GAMAAN contradict established pollsters and lack the transparency of a formal peer review process, suggesting a coordinated effort may be underway to skew public opinion and build a case for Western intervention. The situation highlights a dangerous trend where questionable data backed by politically motivated organizations is used to influence foreign policy. The lack of academic rigor and the clear political agenda behind the polling raises alarms about the spread of misinformation.
In the Northern Territory, human rights advocates are sounding the alarm over proposed changes to the Youth Justice Act, warning the new laws will have a devastating impact on Indigenous children. The amendments would see detention used as a first resort, reintroduce spit hoods for children, and allow criminal records to follow them into adulthood. These regressive steps come as the number of Indigenous deaths in custody since the Royal Commission has surpassed 600, with critics calling the new laws a violation of human rights. Organisations like National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service and Amnesty International argue these punitive measures will only trap more Indigenous children, many already victims of the child protection system, in a cycle of incarceration. There are now strong calls for the federal government to suspend funding for NT policing and prisons until there is a shift in approach. Instead of punishment, advocates are demanding investment in community-led, trauma-informed support systems that address the root causes of youth crime and work to keep families together.
The Israeli government has unleashed a multi-million dollar propaganda campaign on YouTube across Europe, aiming to justify its military operations and push a narrative about an Iranian nuclear threat. The ads have reached tens of millions of viewers in the UK, France, and Germany, often with questionable claims portraying Israel as a humanitarian force, a stark contrast to the reality of its widespread destruction in Gaza. Google is facing intense criticism for profiting from this campaign, which appears to violate its own policies against promoting violence and shocking content. The campaign has also brought Google's close relationship with the Israeli state into sharp focus, which includes significant financial investments and the hiring of former Israeli intelligence agents. This raises serious questions about the platform's neutrality and the ability of a state to flood a platform like YouTube with state-sponsored propaganda, effectively drowning out dissenting voices and Palestinian perspectives, highlights the immense power these tech giants wield in shaping global political discourse.
The Australian government is threatening to shut down the encrypted messaging service Signal in a move widely seen as a major assault on privacy. Canberra is demanding that Signal create a backdoor to its system, which would grant intelligence agencies access to private user data. Signal has stated it will pull its services from Australia entirely before it compromises the security and privacy of its users, setting up a major battle over digital rights. This push is part of a broader expansion of the state's surveillance powers under the guise of national security. Human rights organisations warn that forcing a backdoor into encrypted services is a dangerous overreach of government power that will have a chilling effect on free speech and political dissent. This move by a key member of the Five Eyes Global Surveillance Network sets a dangerous precedent, threatening the right to private communication for everyone.
Two Israeli citizens, Tanya Safi and Robert Martin, have been illegally abducted by Israeli forces in international waters while participating in a humanitarian mission to Gaza. The incident is a clear violation of international law, yet the response from the Albanese government has been shamefully muted, prompting harsh criticism that Canberra is failing to protect its own citizens from a rogue state. Safi and Martin were part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, a peaceful convoy attempting to break the illegal and devastating blockade of Gaza. Further, according to the coalition, IDF soldiers beat and choked the American labor activist Chris Smalls, who was on board the ship. Smalls is most well known for co-founding the Amazon Labor Union and was the only black person on board the Handala. This is not the first time Israel has violently intercepted these aid missions. The abduction serves as another stark reminder of the brutality of the ongoing siege and the impunity with which the Israeli state operates, an impunity that appears to be enabled by the inaction of Western governments like our own.
And finally, this week China has urged Manila to stop its provocative military actions and cease collaborating with external powers on maritime issues in the South China Sea. The warning comes as the Philippines deepens its defence ties with the United States and Japan, a move that Beijing sees as a direct threat to regional stability. Chinese officials are making it clear that these military alliances will not resolve disputes and will only escalate tensions. The core of the issue is the Philippines' reliance on outside forces, particularly the US, to back its claims in the region. Beijing maintains that these disputes are matters for the countries in the region to resolve among themselves without foreign interference. By bringing in external military powers, Manila is not only complicating the issue, but is dangerously turning the South China Sea into a potential flashpoint for a much larger conflict, undermining years of effort to maintain peace and dialogue in one of the world's most critical waterways. And those are the news headlines for Wednesday, the 30th of July.
And we'll be back in a minute.
Hey, I got a message for you. You got a message for me. My day will come together and sit down by the fire.
Every Wednesday at 11 a.m, join me, Bunzolini, at the fire.
On Community Radio 3CR. Three hours of historically informed, critical analysis of Aboriginal affairs and the ongoing political movement for land rights, treaty, sovereignty and the cessation of genocide. Featuring the best of black music. Bunzel's Fire, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Wednesday on Community Radio 3CR.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
And we're back. It's 13 minutes past 7. And we're joined by Eugene Doyle. Eugene is a writer based in Wellington, although he's actually calling us right now from London, staying up very late. So thank you so much for that, Eugene. Eugene's written extensively on the Middle East, as well as peace and security issues in our region and the Asia Pacific. And this morning, actually, we're talking about the upcoming 80th anniversary of the Nagasaki Peace Memorial Ceremony, which is being held in about 10 days on August the 9th. Good morning, Eugene. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're from London, Jesse. Great to be with you.
What's it like over there at the moment in London?
I had a pleasant start to the trip, but I'm actually keen to get down to Parliament and show a bit of support to the excellent people who are outside Parliament every day protesting against the genocide in Gaza. It's good to be here.
Oh, one of my colleague's 80-year-old mother has decided that maybe it's time for her to get arrested over this. So that was exciting news personally.
Hey, isn't that so interesting? I think so many of us are at, we realise what's going on, and it's like, what more can we do? What lines do we have to cross to actually get it across to our criminal governments that this has to stop?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I look forward to maybe chatting with you about your adventures over there in London, and would be great to learn more about what it's like over there for the activists and what's going on there in regards to Palestine activism and Palestine action as well, perhaps. But this morning we're going to chat about the Nagasaki Peace Memorial Ceremony, the 80th anniversary. Would you mind giving a bit of background to the why there's this memorial ceremony? I think we all have a bit of an idea, but perhaps a bit more detail could be useful.
Sure. So, and the 6th of August, 1945, you had the Hiroshima bombing, and you know, the first use of nuclear weapons in war. And then 3 days later, you had Nagasaki. So on the 9th of August. And I guess why we're talking, Jesse, is because of really two incredible stories that the mainstream media largely ignored. I wrote a story last year about the boycott by the G7 group of countries plus Australia and New Zealand, who refused to attend the 79th anniversary of the bombing, staged a walkout because their best buddy, their bosom friend, Israel, had been excluded from the commemorations last year. Mm-hmm. So the G7 plus Australia and New Zealand just said, well, gosh, if Israel hasn't been invited, we're not coming. So it was an incredible slap in the face to the Hibakusha, the survivors of the bomb, and the city of Nagasaki itself.
Yeah, it was kind of like a weird BDS, like a reverse kind of BDS, but it's happening by states, in support of Israel.
Yeah, well, that's dead right, actually. Yeah, and so if you leap forward to this year, and the reason I guess I'm on air now is I picked up something that once again, you tell me if you've read this, but didn't seem to get reported in our media, that what actually happened subsequently. So the enormous pressure was applied to the Japanese, particularly by that boycott last year. So they thoroughly got the message. The Israeli media reported that the Americans and I assume the other powerful white nations were part of this too, gave the Japanese the message that it was not acceptable to exclude Israel from the peace ceremony, the commemoration at Nagasaki. So the city of Nagasaki was forced to do what they had never previously done. They actually went and personally invited the Israelis to attend this year's ceremony in a few days' time. So you've got this astonishing situation where a country that is actively doing a genocide against the Palestinian people has been invited to one of the most important peace ceremonies in the world. And the only reason they are there is because of the powerhouse pressure from our governments. And, I'm astonished that's not a major story. Mm. And B, what a terrible and shocking thing. And what does it say about our countries, Jesse?
Absolutely. And the bombing of Nagasaki in 1945 by the United States military, it did kill, just in Nagasaki, around 74,000 people at the time. And like you mentioned, the whole point of the ceremony is to honor the victims, but also express a wish for lasting world peace and advocate for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And I had read that last year when Israel was excluded, that was absolutely wholly supported by survivors, and including, I think it was the organizer or one of the main leads of the commemoration, was saying yes, like this is entirely appropriate.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, Shigemitsu Tanaka. So he was the head at the time of the Nagasaki Atomic Bomb Survivors Council. Mm. He said, And they were terribly polite to the Israelis, but he said he supported the move to keep the Israelis away from the commemorations because he said it was inappropriate to invite representatives from countries waging armed conflicts in defiance of calls from the international community, which you'd have to say is a perfectly reasonable thing. And it just underlines the lengths to which New Zealand, Australia, and the other countries are prepared to support Israel in its crimes. And, you know, as I pointed out in an article just a few days ago, you really do know who your true mates are when you're committing genocide. And unfortunately, Australia and New Zealand have shown that they are really, really good mates of Israel at this very moment.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. We have seen a slight shift here in Australia, of course, not in terms of material actions, but in rhetoric. There's been, from our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, and even some of the mainstream media's kind of seems to be maybe telling a little bit of truth here and there. Just speaking about it and not doing anything. Has that been similar in New Zealand as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And you see all over the Western world, there's various media commentators in the mainstream, and I think they're trying to protect their asses, to be honest, where they're finally sort of coming to the conclusions people like you and I came to very shortly after October 7 last year, that something truly horrendous, a genocide was you know, well underway already. And of course, you know, we were right, and all the people who were huffing and puffing and saying nothing to see here have been proven wrong. And I think some of them are seeking political cover for their actions, but also in the case of the governments, they're really just fudging along, as you said. You know, rhetoric. You know, that's all very fine, but actually, there's practical things you can do, and our governments will actually have to be dragged towards doing the right thing by our population. So we really need to mobilise our populations in the Western world to just wake up to the fact that there's a genocide been live streamed, the first live streamed genocide in human history, and too many of us are still sitting on the bench.
Just on back to Nagasaki, was there anything else you wanted to mention regarding the commemoration?
Oh, well, I think you actually touched on something really important, Jesse, when you mentioned the reverse boycott by the G7 countries. But why they acted so powerfully, so resolutely against the city of Nagasaki, and this has been celebrated in the Israeli media, is because of BDS. So that's the boycotts, divestments, and sanctions movement, which actually is 20 years old this year, just, you know, another important marker. And BDS, so getting people and organisations and countries to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel is enormously important. And one of the really key tools that the international community and individuals can use against the racist apartheid state of South Africa, of Israel. And that's why the Israelis, supported by us, has gone to such incredible lengths to really break the BDS movement, and in fact the city of Nagasaki was effectively part of the BDS movement until they were pushed into place by those powerful white-dominated countries. And I think, yeah, we've just got to keep on pushing for our governments to take firmer stands, like boycotting Israel, you know, ensuring that our governments cease to provide this criminal support to the Israeli state.
And if anyone has doubts about the effectiveness of the BDS movement, the Israeli government has actually put out an advertisement which shows Israeli orange juice morphing into missiles and things like that, which really make clear the direct link between the Israeli products and the military complex there and the genocide.
Well said, and well, also another way you can really tell BDS is important and working is that you have Israeli ministers threatening people in the West who are part of the movement with targeted killings, and the leaders in Palestine of the BDS movement suffer horrendous consequences. So you can be sure BDS is a powerful tool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Eugene. Was there any last things you wanted to mention before we let you go this morning?
Oh, well, I think one of your journalists, Caitlin Johnstone, Australian journalist, said something very powerful, very eye-opening earlier this month. She said, if you're still supporting Israel in the year 2025, there is something seriously wrong with you as a person. Very harsh. But I have to say that goes triple for governments. You know, and you know, I mean, gosh, I lived for a while in Israel. I'm not against human beings, but I'm certainly against governments that commit these terrible crimes. And it's high time that Australians and New Zealanders really woke up to the fact that our governments are participants, are enablers of this terrible crime.
100%. And love Caitlin Johnston. She's very good at cutting directly to the truth. Yeah, we're lucky to have her. Thank you, Eugene. You can read some of Eugene's excellent work on his public policy platform, solidarity.co.nz. And often, Eugene, I've found some of your pieces on Pearls and Irritations. I would highly recommend subscribing, of course.
And maybe just mention that there is a snap rally happening at 6 o'clock on Friday outside the State Library to bring pots and pans to make a noise for Gaza. The tagline is Gaza is starving, words won't feed them.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonia. Thank you, Eugene.
Well done to all of you on your excellent work. That's really important, providing an alternative voice. So well done.
Thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy your time in London. I look forward to chatting with you again in the near future.
Ka kite.
It will not address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Awa Dombia is an artist from Mali out in West Africa.
And coming up now on the line, we've got Dr. Scott Bennett, who is a senior lecturer in marine ecology at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania, to talk to us about the algal blooms off the coast of South Australia. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Sorry, I'm just having a bit of difficulty here hearing you. Could you, first of all, just, I mean, obviously this has been going on for a while now, but could you just tell us a bit about the history, how long algal blooms have been a problem off the South Australian coast, and perhaps a little bit about what's causing it.
Yes. I'm hearing an echo there. I'm just going to... Is that better?
Yes, I think so. Okay. We can hear you fine now.
Terrific. Yes, so the algal bloom in South Australia has been occurring since early March this year, and it seems to be have been triggered by a combination of factors. One of the primary ones was a really strong marine heat wave that occurred off the coast of South Australia through summer, where we saw sea temperatures well above, you know, a couple of degrees, 2 to 3 degrees above our long-term temperatures, summer temperatures down there. And that was in combination with really warm air temperatures and uncharacteristically still conditions. So we didn't get the usual strong westerly winds. Conditions were really still. And so we had these really warm, calm conditions on a layer of quite nutrient-rich water. And that was basically the perfect environment for these microalgae to bloom. And since then, we've seen just enormous blooms of microalgae. The primary species are species of Karenia, and they've just, first noticed down around Victor Harbour on the Fluorio Peninsula, but has since spread, you know, across through Kangaroo Island, up the Gulf of St Vincent, like into the metropolitan coast around Adelaide and across to the Spencer Gulf, and we now see it moving up towards Whyalla, where we have these really unique cuttlefish aggregations.
There's been these conditions in place for a couple of years now. What has been different about this year, do you think, or is it just an accumulation of stresses on the system?
Yeah, what was quite unique about this year was the marine heat wave for South Australia. So that was one of the most intense marine heat waves we've seen in South Australia up until now. And so that's likely to have been one of the really key triggers for this. You're right, the nutrient conditions. So, you know, I think it's good to clarify that the true cause and the exact like combination of things that have led to this, there still needs to be a huge amount of work done. We know that the Murray flooded 2 years ago, and that caused a huge nutrient plume out into South Australian gulfs. We know that there's been really strong coastal upwelling events, particularly like over a year ago now, and they've also contributed to really strong nutrient pulses in the area. And then there's local effects as well, local inputs as well. And so there are a combination of nutrient factors, but it really seems to be a combination of marine heat wave conditions with those warm, still air conditions that have played a key role here.
And given that our listenership is largely in Melbourne, could you explain what the impacts are? We're not seeing the fish washing up on our shores here. So perhaps some idea of just how widespread the impacts are and what it's like around the coasts of South Australia at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly devastating across the coast of South Australia. It's really unprecedented in the magnitude of impacts on marine life. We've not seen anything like this, particularly from an algal bloom in Australia before. So currently there's more than 450 species that have been recorded washed up onto beaches of South Australia. And these species range from everything. I think there's been something like 10 great white sharks wash up. So everything from big sharks and rays right down to the smallest critters, so like little sandhoppers. Are dead, a lot of the sponges and seaweeds and habitat forming species. So this is and everything in between. So it really has impacted the entire food web, the entire marine ecosystem. And that's, I mean, that's incredibly devastating and obviously really hard, particularly for the South Australians to see. In a sense, it's fortunate that we're actually getting this stuff washing up on shore, so we do have, you know, this visual, you know, cue that the impact's underwater, because we know it's highly likely that what's washing up on shore is really the tip of the iceberg, and the true devastation is underwater. And so far, we've done some preliminary surveys over there. I was involved in some preliminary surveys back in mid-June, but that's really, really the true impacts and the full extent of the impacts underwater are unknown. But yeah, this extends over 500 kilometres of coastline. Literally tens of thousands of animals have died and have washed up, let alone all those underwater that remain unseen.
And I mean, to me, it seems like we're in the middle of winter now and things should be abating somewhat.
Yeah, that's right. And that was, I guess, the hope of authorities for quite a while. You know, when this took off, we were like, the hope was when winter storms hit and all the seawater was mixed up, this would dissipate, this bloom would dissipate and disappear. That hasn't happened. We've seen it continue. It has moved. So where it initially bloomed, for example, isn't necessarily still blooming. It has abated there and cleaned up. But it keeps moving and it keeps propagating. And like we said, now it's over in the Spencer Gulf and putting the cuttlefish aggregations at risk. One of the ideas, like how this is happening it remains somewhat unclear still, but these species are not necessarily, they can be mixotrophic, so they don't just rely on photosynthesis to survive. They can also, fuel themselves through heterotrophy. And what we're seeing, or they're seeing now, the records of the Karenia are quite close to the bottom. One of the ideas is they're actually now basically feeding themselves, receiving their nutrition, the nutrients from decomposing marine life on the seafloor, and that's actually helping stimulate the continuing bloom of the of them. But again, it's still really early days. There's so many unknowns with this algal outbreak at the moment. One of the other really terrifying things, but unknown things, is these blooms are one of the reasons they're killing so much marine life is because of the toxins they're producing. And they're producing a type of toxin, brevitoxins, which are actually harmful to human health. And we still don't know exactly what species these are coming from. These brevitoxins are not known to the common species of Karenia that have been identified in the bloom. So there's other species in there, and there's just a lot about the underlying causes and makeup of this algal bloom that are still unknown.
Now, I want to come back to the response of the government being, let's just hope it goes away at winter. But before I do that, can I just ask you, what do you think? I mean, we're seeing mass die-offs of not just the fish and things that are washing up, but mollusks and that. What is the long-term impact, or is the suspected long-term impact on the health of the marine ecosystems?
I mean, that's a great question, and it's still probably too early to tell. As I said, we still don't know the full extent of these impacts, but we expect that the long-term impacts could be extremely devastating. It's worth remembering that Southern Australia, the Great Southern Reef, the waters around South Australia where these impacts are occurring, are extremely, one, biodiverse, and two, unique. So around 70% of the species we get on reefs around South Australia there are endemic. They're unique to the Great Southern Reef, to Southern Australia. And once they're gone, they're gone. And we have, you know, until now, these waters around South Australia have been a real refuge and sentinel for our unique reef species. We've been seeing mass population declines in the southeast, like off the coast of Victoria and Tasmania, and the southwest off the southwest coast of WA. And that's because, you know, it's been the southeast and southwest which has really been warming quite quickly, much warmer than average rates of global ocean warming. And South Australia until now has been quite protected from that. That's all out the window now. So these really unique species are being heavily impacted, and it is quite possible that we may lose species. And given that, yeah, that's it. Their entire global distribution is concentrated, they're only found in southern Australia. There are chances that we will see species extinctions, potentially, certainly mass population declines. And a lot of these species are really iconic and unique. So we think about South Australia, we think about leafy sea dragons, for example, only found through southern Australia, particularly South Australia and southwestern Australia. We've seen mass mortality and wash-ups of some of these iconic species like leafies. And as well, a lot of really iconic light-attached species, things like blue devilfish. We know they live for a really long time. They just stay under the same rocks. They're really iconic, you know, tourist attraction. These sorts of species are being heavily impacted. The long-term recovery of that. First, we need to be able to get in the water and assess the full extent of these impacts, and then we'll be able to make a judgment.
And before going on to what can be done and what should be being done, what about species outside? I mean, you've said that it's possibly dangerous for humans who go into the waters and things like that. What about other animal and plant species that are not marine dwelling? Are they likely to be impacted?
I don't know.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
All good. So let's go on to what the response has been and whether it meets up to the challenge.
Yeah, so we've seen in the past week the federal government pledge $14 million to the Australian state government, and the South Australian state government has matched that. That is very welcome emergency funds to tackle this issue. Those funds, I understand, are going to a combination of things, but one of those is early detection and bloom monitoring infrastructure in the water. Also, this early impact assessment of fish stocks and marine life in the marine sanctuaries, which is very welcome. And then obviously a lot of support for industry and that have been affected. So it is welcome, but it is also, you know, relatively modest given the scale and the magnitude of this investment, and that has been recognised by state and federal government. I expect this will be the first tranche of funding that South Australia requires to deal with these impacts, because this, again, as we've discussed, is going to have, it's already had really profound impacts, but these are going to be long-lasting for South Australian people and the marine environment.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
And what about for the longer-term prospects? Is it likely that this is going to recur given global heating and things? Or is this hopefully a one-off that we're not likely to see again in future?
I wish. Unfortunately, there is a strong chance that this will reoccur, both in South Australia but also elsewhere. Like these species of harmful algae are known to occur, they do occur elsewhere throughout Australia, New Zealand, and we've seen blooms in other parts of Australia. We see them in Victoria, in Tasmania, New South Wales, and nothing of this scale before. But all the ingredients are there in other parts of the country, and as well in South Australia. We have this increasing intensity and frequency of marine heat waves, back of climate change, and once these microalgae are in the system, then they typically stay there, and the reoccurrence of blooms is increasingly likely. So, sadly, this may be a new norm,
that's terrifying.
A reality that we have to deal with, and that really just highlights the importance of being more organised. Basically, we've seen a really slow and disorganised response in South Australia this time, because I guess we just didn't know what we were dealing with, and we need to learn the lessons from that. We need to have task force at the ready to be able to respond and deal with these crises ahead of time, and start looking at all proactive measures that we can do.
I know we're going on a bit now, but what are the proactive measures that can be done if an early detection system, let's say, was in place?
Yeah, so again, it's a good, very good question. And for things like harmful algal blooms and for these large climatic-driven events, often there's relatively limited things we can do once these events are in place. I guess it's always worth reflecting that the number one thing we need to do is to cut our emissions.
Yeah.
We're not going to solve any of these problems unless we get serious on climate change and realise the impact it's having and cut our emissions. That needs to remain a number one priority. Obviously, that's part of a longer game as well, and we need to have sort of more regional, local scale actions and measures that we can do to help system. Some early warnings of the HABs, of these harmful algal blooms, would be helpful, particularly for the seafood sector, for example, to as it does affect potentially seafood health and so there's consumer health concerns that need to be realised quickly. Maybe it's about getting stock out of the water earlier or things like that. But there's also things we can do to reduce local pressures. So looking after our coastal waterways, looking after our catchments, minimising nutrient inputs into the system, and really doubling down on looking after our coastal marine habitats. So we know the vital role that kelp forests, seagrass meadows, oyster reefs, these things play, and actually filtering our coastal waters, coastal marine environment, taking nutrients out of the system. And this is basically, this is critical function that these habitats play to maintain clean waterways and basically minimise the likelihood that these blooms will occur. And so, doubling down on our efforts to maintain these healthy systems is important as well.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Scott. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but I will put a link to the greatsouthernreef.com website in our show notes, because there's a lot of really terrifying, really, information there about the impacts and things, and they're doing regular updates as well. So thanks very much for your time. And we might try and get in touch again in future if this persists.
Terrific.
Thanks.
Let's hope it doesn't persist, but indeed. Yeah, it's been lovely talking to you.
Lovely. Have a great morning. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And that was Dr. Scott Bennett, who is a senior lecturer in marine ecology, talking about the algal blooms off the coast of South Australia and the impact that it's having, and also prospects for the future.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view. The people who work in the prison system would have another. And I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
And you're back at 7:54, 3CR 855 AM. We're joined now by Roscoe Lee Brown of Radio Rada, joining us to discuss Rada News, Kanaki and Indigenous Liberation News from Oceania region and beyond. And this morning, we have a couple of updates from Kanaki and Jamaica. Good morning, Roscoe. How are you going?
Morning. Good morning, 3CR. Dear listener, Roscoe Lee Brown, Radio Rada here. Deep in the Valley of the Beast in Canberra.
Oh, in Canberra. That is the Valley of the
Canberra.
Beast.
It is the Valley of the Beast. Strange place, Canberra. It's all square. It concrete. Is.
And lots of roundabouts, square and round.
Yeah, yeah. Round on the ground and square in the air. Yeah, yeah. And it's good to hear the word revolution in the lead into this segment. There's plenty of revolution out there.
Absolutely.
In the ocean kingdoms. Jesse, I'm just back from the International Seabed Authority meeting in Kingston, Jamaica, and a CARICOM meeting. And there's revolution all over the place.
Okay, yeah,
we might
please
start
tell
with,
us.
And, yeah. Yeah, well, we and Kanaki as well. We might start with Kanaki if I can.
Yeah.
Dear listener, there is a voice-style referendum question about to be put to the Kanaki population, or the New Caledonia population, more to the point. France has decided to offer Kanaki a kind of form of statehood instead of independence, and they are going to prosecute this with a yes-no style referendum question in February 2026. It's interesting, Sinawami, the Grand Chief, and Christian Tien, the leader of the political kind of independence. they've been talking over the last little bit by telephone, as I understand it. Christian Tien still in France, out of prison, but still in France, mm-hmm. not allowed to return to Kanaki. And Sinawami in Yeresheba on the Isle of Mare. They've been thinking and talking about a fellow called Jean-Marie Thibarot, who was the kind of intellectual leader of the civil war, or the rise for independence in the 70s and 80s. He did not trust the Namur Accords that brought us to the point we're at now.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the late 70s, he talked about the status of autonomy that the Namur Accords offered locks us in. So it's on the principle of the act of self-determination that we discuss, have any kind of conversation. Because autonomy in colonial context is not a liberation, but a confinement.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing that's facing the good and true customary and other people in so-called New Caledonia. They're about to be offered a yes-no question that they can only vote no to. And then, they'll be labelled, I suspect, as the racists, because mm-hmm. the settler... The colonial settler in that stolen wealth of New Caledonia regard themselves as indigenous and regard any reference by Kanak people to be indigenous as an act of racism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's bizarre. The way this whole thing's been framed. That's the way this independence, or what France is calling autonomy, is being framed. That if the Kanak do not agree, that's an act of aggression against white people.
So it's a yes-no referendum based on, and the question is around autonomy from France, is that right?
No, well, in with France or to France. Do you get autonomy from something?
Okay.
I guess you do get it from something, but this is a state within France.
Yes, okay, I understand.
Is what's being offered. So right. In the same way that the voice referendum here in Australia, if it passed, would have meant that there are no Aboriginal people because there would only be Australians.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, in New Caledonia, the question is, do you want to become a Caledonian?
Wow. Yeah,
that's your independence.
How do you vote with anything else but no? Yeah.
Well, exactly. There is no positive answer to that by anybody who thinks that they are working towards independence.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Also, the Seabed Authority, Jesse and dear listener, 3CR, Roscoe Lee Brown here from Radio Rada, just back from the International Seabed Authority meeting in Kingston, Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moratorium on this seabed mining idea, but it's only a moratorium at this institutional level. In fact, the US is, you know, pushing ahead apace to try to develop this industry. They couldn't get any agreement between the member states at this Seabed Authority meeting, remembering, dear listener, that they were attempting to create a mining code that divides the world oceans into 75,000 square kilometre mining lots. It turns out that all of the bottom silt on the ocean is rare earth, because all of the little animals in the water column up to the size of calamari ingest fresh water and it turn it into copper, gold and rare earth.
Mm.
And so the International Seabed Authority has been meeting for 14 years, a UN instrument in Kingston, Jamaica. The most recent, having just finished on the 25th of July, was the 30th meeting of this organisation. And they were trying to ratify a mining code, but they haven't been able to get that ratification up because member states wouldn't sign up to it, because there's no real clarity and it doesn't provide any protection. Led by Chile and Mexico, the thing kind of got knocked over. But the US is, kind of charging ahead in this area, granting leases and encouraging this activity. It is why they renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Did they call it the Gulf of America?
I
think it was the Gulf of America, not the Gulf of the United States.
But
they've done that in order to get to be able to allow mining companies in there under American jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Because like all of the UN instruments, the United States is operating outside of them these days. The same with the ICC, the same with the ICJ in relation to the prosecution of Netanyahu and his defense minister for war crimes.
Mm.
In the same way, they are operating outside of that. In the same way, they're encouraging their G7 and G20 partners to do the same. It's kind of the reason why they couldn't get this mining code ratified at the UN level, because there's disquiet and discomfort among the member states that this mining code does not provide any protection for the oceans, and particularly no protection for customary owners' claims to this country.
Yeah, and when you say the member states, are they the UN member states? Are they all attending?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah, the UN member states. And then there were representatives. So I hung out with the kind of community organisations and ex officio or non-government organisations there was a get-together at Bushlife in the Rockabessa over a couple of days, a little conference. Actually, I met some people from Kenya at that gathering. A fellow called Ladama Mozidza.
Yeah.
Is that?
I'm not sure.
My pronunciation's going to be terrible. But he told us stories about Kenyan connection to sea country.
Mm.
He's an ocean man, many generations. Bajuni country in the Lamu Archipelago.
Yeah.
In northern Kenya, apparently.
It's beautiful.
He told a beautiful story at this gathering about his community's connection to the ocean and their fears. What he says is that the narratives of loss and vulnerability have replaced their traditional stories.
Mm.
And so, you know, that the colonizer has rewritten history that starts at enslavement.
Mm.
It does not deal with or you know, give any credence to what happened before that. And this young fella, and he was, you know, maybe 35, he's leading a bunch of people, a bunch of autochthon across the ocean kingdoms in the work of recovering narrative around sea stories.
Wow.
As part of the kind of opposition to this international seabed authority attempt to, you know, turn the oceans into mining leases.
Wow, that's super powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. One last thing, I went to a CARICOM meeting. So CARICOM's like CHOGM for the Caribbean. CHOGM's the Commonwealth Leaders Meeting. You know,
okay.
This is a Caribbean Leaders Meeting. They were talking about reparation and reparatory justice, and CARICOM. And bringing an action at the Privy Council level against King Charles. Basically, in the same way that Robbie Thorpe is trying to prosecute a genocide case against King Charles here in so-called Australia,
mm-hmm.
the Caribbean are basing their reparations claim on the genocide of enslavement and transport away from homelands.
Okay.
So this idea, and I have to say that the Kanaki work, the Tibaro work that Sinuami and Tiena are engaging in, the seabed authority opposition or the autochthonal opposition to this seabed authority attempt to turn the